never find. As long as you live, someone who loves you tender like I do, you'll never find.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with fellow beat writer Bob McGinn. It's a little after 9 o'clock here at the McGinn headquarters west of Lambeau Field. It's a late night, but we're here. How's it going, Bob?
Good, Mike. It's quite late. How's your energy level?
I'm hungry, and I'm sleepy, yeah. But we give the fans what they want, and so that's why we're here.
Let's get through this. I want to watch the Chiefs and the Raider, my tape that I'm taping below.
I'd like to go to sleep, so we're even.
So I will never see a commercial, Mike. Never watch a commercial.
It's impossible to watch television with you because it's 2 seconds forward, 8 seconds back, pause, rewind, fast forward, slow motion. Did you see this?
Mike, I never saw a political commercial this whole cycle for 2 years. I never watched one.
I don't think that's true.
I think it is.
When you were encouraging me to register to vote, I remember you identifying certain candidates and saying, this commercial, these commercials.
Just what I read about in the Journal Sentinel about commercials.
Okay, okay.
I don't believe in that, Mike.
So who'd you pick tonight?
The Chiefs, automatically.
Why automatically? Remind our kind listeners.
It was my Super Bowl pick. I still have a shot to win it all with the Chiefs. They're 9-3, and I just keep circling them every week, and they're producing.
Well, I think that they're going to win tonight. I like the Chiefs tonight.
I'm hopeful.
I like that defense.
Ever hopeful.
Maybe they'll win just because you wrote that column about Andy Reid. They'll be inspired by it.
Andy's pretty good in that turnover differential, Mike.
Yes, he is.
Yep.
But before we jump into some more football-related stuff, it was your turn to choose the music. And I got a lot of flack for my choice last week. Not a lot of people like those boy bands from the 90s,
oh,
Bob.
You took some heat?
I took some heat.
Wow.
Some people on Twitter saying, never select that music again.
Wow.
I got a message from one guy saying, when I turned it on, I swore to God this was going to be Bob's selection.
Well, nobody can rip the selection tonight.
I agree. I like it, too.
I mean, Mr. Lou Rawls. Come on. He's one of the classic guys. You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine, I believe is the official title. 1976. Frank Sinatra. Oh, Lou, by the way, won a Grammy on that one. Frank said of this, of Lou, he has the classicest singing voice and slickest chops in the singing game. Lou passed away in 2006 at age 72. He's unreal. Soulful man. He's an icon. He's great. Mr. Lou Rawls.
Good choice.
Thank you.
Good choice. Anything else on our docket here before we jump into the less fun portion of the podcast?
Not that I have. How about you, Mike?
Well, it's time to warn the listeners that there may or may not be a podcast next week. And I know what you're thinking. You guys skipped Thanksgiving. You took one off for the bye week. You know, what are we doing to us? Well, we're sorry. But, you know, we don't really get a bonus for these podcasts. So sometimes some other things in life come first. And actually, on Monday, the day after the Seahawks game, I'm having knee surgery. And I know I've mentioned on this podcast before that I've been having some knee issues. And it's time to get them fixed Monday afternoon. I don't know exactly what's going to be done because some of the scans and things were inconclusive. So we will see. But one interesting little tidbit. My surgeon is going to be the Packers doctor, Pat McKenzie, who also did surgery on Charlie, right?
Yep, my son, right, when he was a sophomore in high school, basketball injury.
ACL, was it?
MCL.
MCL,
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so I will be laid up for a few days, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be up to doing a podcast, depending on how much pain I'm in and how loopy I am from those wonderful medications that they give you. So we'll see. But if there's no podcast, now you know why, and we apologize in advance. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this podcast is sponsored by Cannon and Dunphy. So now we can jump into the meat of this baby. And what did we see most recently? Well, we saw a snow game, and the Packers defeated the Texans. What was the final score?
21-13.
That was my first snow game at Lambeau Field. I played soccer in the snow. I've seen college football in the snow. But that was my first game here covering the Packers in the snow. And, you know, one of my friends texted me earlier in that day on Sunday and said, man, you know, neither of these two teams is playing really great football. I think this could be a pretty ugly game. And I said, I don't disagree with you there, but I'm excited to watch this game because it's in the snow. It's fun for me. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And I hope we get more snow this weekend. What do you remember most about snow games over the years, Bob?
There's been a few. As a spectator, I saw the Bears-Packers in December of 75. But certainly the game that comes to mind with anybody with any years around here, Mike, would be the so-called Snow Bowl game. December 1, 1985, Lambeau Field. It seated about 56,000 at the time. 19,856 showed up. It was 30 degrees. I think I didn't have a big problem getting there that day, but I left early. I'm trying to think of the total snowfall. 10 or 11 inches, I think. It maybe started 6 hours before kickoff and didn't end till maybe 18 hours after. It was a long one. But I think the total snowfall was 10 or 11, maybe 6 or 7 on the field. So the Buccaneers came in. They were terrible. And Steve Young was their quarterback.
Oh, okay. The Californian.
Yep. I think he's a Californian or Utah maybe. I don't know. Played at BYU. Yeah. a first-round pick for the Packers, a defensive end by the name of Alfonso Carriker from Florida State, I believe. He had 4 or 5 sacks in that game, Mike, and he was a bust.
Wow.
He loved the snow. And the Buccaneers didn't even want to play. Lynn Dickey passed for almost 300 yards, I think, in that day. And it was really something. 19,000 only showed up. The Packers were an average team. They were in the process of finishing 8-8. Final score was Green Bay 21, Buccaneers 0. That's my big snow game.
I don't see a team from Florida coming in here too often and finding a lot of success in weather like that. And Houston, too, an indoor team now, right? Their stadium's indoors, isn't it now?
Yeah. Houston's a tough team, and they played hard.
They did.
And they were right there. Stats, all that stuff was even. And Jordy Nelson and kind of shot him down, didn't he, down the stretch?
He did. I mean, those catches he made on the last couple drives there were huge. Obviously, that touchdown where he took advantage of the slip by, I can't even remember his name.
Mr. James,
who's now not even on the team anymore. Got cut the next day, I think it was. So it was an entertaining game. The Packers got back to 500 now, 6-6. But what else stood out to you about that game? I mean, for me, one thing, I don't know if it stood out for you, but I was impressed by Ladarius Gunter again.
Hmm.
What do you think?
I mean, he did not match with DeAndre Hopkins.
DeAndre.
But did I ever write DeAndre? No, I wrote DeAndre.
Didn't.
I always looked it up before I wrote it. Thank you. But he was there 50% of the time, I think, and he bodied him. Now, Joe Witt, the cornerback coach, talked today about Gunter. What did he say, Mike?
Well, I asked him, I said, earlier in the week I was asking some of the other cornerbacks about Gunter. And from two different guys I heard that, you know, the one thing that makes him really frustrating for opposing receivers is that because of his long arms and because of the style he likes to play, which is very physical, he always gets his hands on the receivers early in the route, and it bothers them because receivers don't like it when people have hands on them. So I asked Joe Witt, I said, you know, what really does that, why is he able to do that but other corners aren't? You know, because that was what the teammates were saying, is that this is a unique skill that some guys can do, but certainly not all. And basically Witt said that it's a technique that is used by a number of different corners, and the examples he gave were D'Angelo Hall, Charles Woodson, and then the third one,
Tremont Williams,
yes.
Yeah.
And so basically it's a press coverage using your hands. And now obviously that kind of sounds like common sense. Those of you who have watched a lot of football, you know that when a corner plays press coverage, he wants to get his hands on the guys. But one thing that I never really considered, and I thought this was really interesting from Joe Witt, is that he said some guys choose to press more with their hands and other guys are able to do press coverage based on what they can do with their feet. And so that to me was really interesting. But Gunter is a guy that relies on that physicality, and you could see that he wants to be there at the point every time when the ball is thrown. He wants to body you. He wants to get his hands in there. I think he had two pass breakups, and now he's got the most on the team with 9 this season.
I did a real long story with Tremont Williams a year ago, Mike, I think. You were here, right?
He was on the team last year.
Well, that was 2 years ago then, entering the 2014 season. And talking about the feet with Tremont, that's right. I mean, he was not a big hands guy.
Right.
He had very quick feet and catch-up speed, and he never wanted to have especially big guys. I remember after he played Julio Jones a few times, he never wanted to allow them to get to his body. So he figured if he got hands-on with a big guy, he'd get shoved or jammed to his disadvantage. So he just mirrored him with feet. Interesting. But Gunter lacks that catch-up speed, and he's got to do it right quick, doesn't he?
He does. And one of the things that Joe Witt said about Gunter that sort of I had started to recognize on the field, and then it was confirmed, is that, you know, Gunter's a guy that Joe Witt often says is silent. You know, he doesn't say very much. Even when you talk to him in the locker room, he's not unfriendly by any means, but he's very terse. He speaks in short sentences. He doesn't elaborate, and you can tell he's a very serious guy. But against the Texans, there were a couple of times when he would make a nice play or a ball would go incomplete, and he would show a little bit of emotion. You know, one time he crossed his arms like you would say no good or something like that on a field goal. Another time, and this was my personal favorite, after a PBU against Will Fuller, he did the double Dikembe Mutombo finger wag as if to say you're not getting this ball here. Huh. I enjoyed that. And so basically he's starting to settle into this role where he can be a little bit more emotional because he's confident in himself and the way he's playing right now. And Witt said he thinks that Gunter's only had one bad game all season, and that was Dallas. Now, a lot of you might be thinking, well, he gave up that giant touchdown against Washington deep over the top. And Witt said that he does not view that as a bad game for one reason, or two reasons, excuse me. First of all, he said outside of that one play, Gunter played really well. Second of all, he said that was a mistake by the coaches to put Gunter in a position that does not fit his skill set. He should not be in that position against that receiver on that particular play. And so Witt said that's on him and Capers. That's not on Gunter. Okay. I think he's not bad for a guy that's undrafted and doesn't have the speed that traditionally comes with that spot.
I had Nelson as the player of the game, and then Gunter, and then Morgan Burnett. Yeah, Gunter did well. What else about the Houston game, Mike?
Well, this is sort of tangentially related to Gunter, but we also asked Joe Witt today about Casey Hayward.
Yeah.
You wrote a column about him recently. You know, there's no denying the production he has this year. And, you know, Joe Witt was always fond of Hayward, so I asked him today. I said, you know, I don't know how much you've seen him play because obviously it's not an opponent on your schedule this year, but what do you think of what Casey's doing out there? And, you know, Witt had a cold today. You could hear it in the audio. It was clear he wasn't up to 100%. He wasn't really in a bad mood, but he wasn't as, you know, as friendly as he tends to be. And he just lit up immediately when I asked him about Hayward. He started smiling. He was energetic. Couldn't express enough how happy he is for Hayward, and said it just reinforces what he's thought all along, that Hayward is this quote-unquote ball magnet, that the ball is coming to him, and he was just really pleased with him. But when you were coming up with the idea for the column, you know, the general crux of it was that the Packers made the right choice to move on. And when you were formulating the argument and doing your research and everything, what really was it that led you to that belief? Because you're certainly not alone. The price tag is not necessarily one that would have made a lot of sense, combined with some other factors.
I just went back, Mike. I reread my critiques or the rating of the Packer. I run through all those 18. Mike, he really almost never made a play the entire year.
He was just kind of there.
And he was a timid tackler. I'm not saying he was turning stuff down, but he's not a physical player. I thought he played small. I went back and I refreshed my memory on everything, every game. There was just nothing there. And he had been a ball magnet in 2012, his rookie year. He was terrific. He was anticipating.
Six picks that year, right?
Yep. All-rookie team, first Packer corner ever to make all-rookie. And he even played some outside that year when Sam Shields was hurt. But then he had injuries, hamstring ruined his 2013. His 2014 offseason was wrecked by that foot injury. He had a screw inserted, I think it was. So I just thought he had lost his stinger. And I tried to put myself in Ted Thompson's shoes. And you have to look at what these decision makers, what was on the table, what the facts were at the time. He's got Shields coming back. Now, granted, he had had three or four concussions to that point, but he finished the year healthy. You got Randall, who had a decent year. You had Rollins, who had a decent year. Going into their second season, that's when the big jumps occur. You had Gunter, who they liked as a press guy. You had Micah Hyde, who can play nickel or dime. You had Robertson Daniel, who was only active one game, but, I mean, at 6'1", with good sub 4-5 speed, I thought he had a chance. And you had Dimitri Goodson, who wasn't suspended at that point. So that's a lot of guys. And at this point, to me, yeah, Hayward's fine. I would have liked to have had him on a roster, but as a fourth, fifth guy, you could never pay him enough money to do that. I mean, that would have been ridiculous to pay him what San Diego did. And so he was just gone. That's just the way it goes. I mean, I think it was a very wise decision to get a small guy, kind of a timid guy, whose career was going the other way. Now, is Thompson and me wrong?
I don't necessarily think so. I think it's much easier. Let's take Hayward's performance this year completely out of it. In other words, throw his stats out, throw all the interceptions, the PBUs out the door, and just look in hindsight at what they have now. They've got Shields, who is hurt, but you know you know what you to expect from Shields when he's on the field. But then you've got Gunter, who's been okay, Rollins, who's really struggled in my opinion at times this year. Randall, who has not looked as good as he did last year when he's in there. Goodson, I thought, exceeded expectations a little bit in the larger role than what he should have. And then Robertson Daniels not here. Josh Hawkins, a little disappointing. So the only criticism you can have of Ted Thompson is that perhaps he put a little bit too much stock into the seasons his rookies had last year. And the only reason I say that is because when you ask any of these guys in the secondary, especially like a Morgan Burnett and Clinton Dix, the first thing they tell you about Sam Shields is that when Sam's on the field, you can stick him on one side and you don't really have to help there very much. You don't really have to worry about him. So what that tells me is that maybe these rookies benefited a little bit from having extra help in their direction, and that this year with no Shields, when they've had to play a little bit more straight up, maybe that's contributed to some of the struggles. But in terms of the price, and in terms of the opportunity, let's not forget, Casey Hayward wants to play outside. That's what he wanted. And if he came back to Green Bay, even if he came back for reasonable money, there was no guarantee that he was going to get that chance because of how high they were on Randall.
For sure, and Rollins.
And so I don't think Casey Hayward wanted to come back to a situation where, A, there was competition, B, he was probably going to have to take below money market or below market value money, and C, he'd be in a position where he might not get to play the spot on the field that he wants to play. And so you put all those things together, and I think they made the right choice at the time, but with the benefit of hindsight, of course, it makes it look like it's much easier to have kept him. And then you throw in his stats from this season, which have been tremendous in his own right, and you say, well, you know, of course we would have liked him. But the one thing that jumped out to me is, you know, you talked about how he didn't make plays last year, how he looked timid at times. And then I was reading the quotes from the personnel directors or the scouts that you spoke to, and they basically echoed that and said, but he's rewritten the story this year. What did they really think of his performance so far this season?
Well, two guys offered this, that he's a zone guy. His anticipation, just everything about him is better in zone, playing off. And that's what John Pagano, the coordinator in San Diego, does. And he's playing more zone this year. Green Bay is a press man team. Now, they've played less this year without Shields, certainly. But they're still predominantly a press man team. They're not like Kansas City, which is probably number one in the whole world in man. But the change in scheme helped him. Now, had he remained in this man, would all these numbers have been happening? Personally, I don't think so.
Probably not, no. But I do think the fit out there is better for him, too, in terms of, you know, not only was he going to be able to play outside, but he was also helped by some injuries out there so that he became essentially their de facto number one, or at least their healthiest guy week to week, so he was the guy. But, I mean, hey, when the ball's come to him, he's made the plays. He leads the league in interceptions by two more than everybody else. And he also has the most PBUs in the league, too.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I also mentioned in here the role of the media in looking back at decisions by decision makers. You know, when I wrote the thing on Vernon Davis a couple weeks ago about the tight end, you know, I immediately heard, well, it's easy to second guess. It's easy to hindsight and all this stuff. Well, within reason, I think it's more than fair to go back and more than legitimate to go back and look at these decisions. I mean, I'm a reporter doing the job basically by myself, relying on my experience, my instincts, talking to people on the phone, talking to sources, scouts who know this game a lot better than I do. The people in Green Bay and everywhere around the NFL, the main decision maker, generally the GM, he has the benefit of unbelievable resources, Mike. Every team in the league has an analytics department, which is sworn and does everything in their power to make sure bad decisions aren't made. I mean, they do these case studies. They have hours upon hours of time. That's all they're doing there. And they're coming up with reams of stuff, databases of all kinds of information to prevent mistakes. That decision maker also has the benefit of two or three or four or five pro scouts in the building. Plus, he could farm it out to a position coach in January or February to prepare for free agency, to study the tapes of these players. Then he has all the time to look at it himself. Are you kidding me? It's their job to get it right, period. And if they don't get it right, they should be out. Now, what helps an organization is when the media or their superiors in the building hold them accountable for these kind of things. And just to throw point blank, can't second guess, can't do hindsight, that's a bunch of crap. They are paid and they have every resource imaginable to get these things right. Now, they're not always going to get it right because it's an inexact human science. But to look back at these decisions with a critical eye, that's going to continue. I'm going to continue to do that.
Had to get that one off your chest there, eh, Bob?
Thank you, Mike.
Anything else you want to talk about related to the Texans game or anything?
Nope, I don't think so.
I do have one thing that I'd like to bring up real quick before we move on. And that is just, I guess, when I watched that game, the one thing that was really fascinating to me, and it didn't occur to me really until I watched the replay, you know, like we always watch the game the day after or whatever the case may be. I guess it didn't dawn on me that when you're playing in those types of conditions and you're an offensive lineman, when you're running the ball as an offensive lineman, you're moving forward. When you're pass protecting, you're moving backward. And so I know you saw this, but that one play where Rodgers throws the touchdown to Nelson as he moves to his left, and Lane Taylor is just sliding by about 6 or 7 feet. To me, it's sort of impressive for both teams that the pass protection was as good as it was, given that when you're moving backwards, you can't stop yourself, and these guys are charging into your chest, and so they're sliding backwards, they're going left and right, and I didn't think either quarterback got clobbered throughout the game. So to me, I was kind of impressed that these guys can move backwards where they have no control over their ability to stop because of the conditions, and yet we didn't see a ton of poor play up front. I don't know, maybe I'm weird like that, but it just didn't really dawn on me until I talked to Lane Taylor about it this morning. Mm. And I said, well, what was going through your head? And he said, well, I basically wanted to turn around to Aaron and say, get out of the way because I'm not stopping.
I'll give you that on the bull rush part of it, Mike, okay, which makes it difficult on the old lineman.
But not traditional rushing around the edge?
Crappy, sloppy, treacherous conditions are an old lineman's best friend.
Really?
Yes. For 35 years, I've been talking to guys about this. I mean, I think of Ken Rutgers, Verba, all these guys. It slows down those rushers. They can't make tight cuts as they can on in the old days, artificial turf, you know.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking that rain would certainly benefit them, but to me, snow, I guess, would seem, because in rain, you can still dig in a little bit, but in the snow, when it's ice, I mean, you can't.
Not rainy grass, you can't. Wet grass.
True.
They love it. Okay. Old linemen love the crap, Mike.
Okay.
And D linemen hate it. The game slows down. It's like quicksand for those D linemen.
All right.
A lot of guys have talked about that over the years.
Okay, yeah. Well then I guess I'm off on that one. I don't know, I just, when you see Lane Taylor sliding back helplessly, yeah, it makes me think that that's not necessarily something they'd enjoy.
No, good point.
We'll have to see how it turns out this weekend. It looks like snow might be in the forecast again, so we'll have to see there. Let's move on to something sort of related to the Seahawks here, and that would be the column that you have today for tomorrow. So it's online. It's probably online now, right? And in the paper Friday. And it's sort of about McCarthy and Pete Carroll, the Packers and the Seahawks. First of all, for those that might not see it, why don't you sort of tell them what the angle of the column is, and then second of all, why you think that this angle is so important in this particular week of the season when the Packers need a win.
You got two Super Bowl winning coaches, Mike McCarthy and Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll's 3-1 against McCarthy. And McCarthy needs a signature win. He needs it badly. He's, what is he, 11-13 since game 6 last year. And he defeated Carroll on this field last September. That's probably the Packers' best game in a long time. Probably go back to New England in 2014. And this is a big moment for Mike McCarthy. He, in his history, Mike, he has gone against Super Bowl-winning coaches. He's coached 35 games against these guys, and he's won 16. He's lost 19. At one point, entering the 2011 playoff game against the Giants, he was 11-10 against Super Bowl-winning coaches. He was like, for example, 2-1 against Mike Holmgren. He had done well against Mike Shanahan, 1-0 against Tony Dungy. So 1-0 against John Harbaugh at that point. And since then, he's 5-9 after he lost that game against Tom Coughlin. So this is a big moment for him. They're an underdog at home, Mike, for the first time since the 2013 playoffs against the 49ers when they were a three-point dog, same as they are against Seattle.
And you called me, or I called you today to talk about something, and you asked me how many times I thought that had happened in the McCarthy era, something like 90-ish games or so. And my guess was less than 10. And what is the number?
It is 10. And in those spots, McCarthy's 5-5 as a home underdog, okay? The biggest spread he's ever won at home, he beat Detroit in 2011 as a 6.5-point dog when Matt Flynn was the quarterback, Green Bay was mailing it in, or theoretically, and they beat the Lions, I think, 41-38. But otherwise, you know, they're 5-5. Now, go ahead, Mike.
One thing, I'm just looking at your data here of the times that they're home underdogs, and for those, obviously, who can't see it, it's interesting because of the 10 games that are on here, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them are 2009 or earlier. Excuse me, 8 of them are 2009 or earlier. So what does that tell you? That once Aaron Rodgers reached his peak, they were almost never, ever, ever a home underdog, regardless of the injury report, regardless of the opponent, regardless of the conditions. Only twice since 2011 have they been home underdogs with Aaron Rodgers.
Only once, Mike. I mean, Detroit was
Oh, that's
Flynn.
Right. That was the Flynn game. So once since 2009.
Yep.
Or excuse me, 2010. Have they been home underdogs with Rodgers?
So when McCarthy got the job, he was coming off a 4-12 under Mike Sherman, and so he was a home dog four times in 2006. He was 0-4 in those games. And then in 2007, Brett Favre was still a quarterback. They were a home dog against the Chargers and the Eagles, and they won both those games. The worst spread Mike McCarthy's ever had was at New England with Flynn in 2010. He was a 14-point dog, and he almost won that game. It was very close. So, you know, when you look at Mike McCarthy's career, and I try to cite some of this, the reason he is where he is really is his dominance of the NFC North. He's 47-17-1 for 7-3-1.
I remember you wrote that column last year about how his dominance in the NFC North has wiped out coach after coach after coach.
Wiped out six of them, two in each place. Childress and Leslie Frazier, Lovie Smith and Mark Trestman, and Rod Marinelli and Jim Schwartz in Detroit. Just gone. He just blows them out of the water, and that's a big reason, certainly. Lovie Smith had his number early, but then that went away, and he got canned. That's just the way the business is. So then he won the Super Bowl in 2010, and he beat a good coach, Mike Tomlin, a Super Bowl-winning coach, in that title game. It was a great, great accomplishment, a great season, tremendous amount of injuries, and he had a young team. Entering the next year in 2011, of their eight best players, only one was older than 28, Charles Woodson. They had it going. They had four starters coming back from IR that year, and they went 15-1. At the same time, Pete Carroll had taken over in Seattle in 2010. He went 7-9 the first 2 years. And then he thought he had solved that quarterback problem by signing Matt Flynn for $10 million guaranteed. John Schneider also had the tremendous foresight to draft Russell Wilson that year in the third round, and we know how that story's gone. At the same time, Jim Harbaugh got the job in San Francisco in 2011, replacing Mike Singletary. Now, when you really look at it, the guy who was really challenging McCarthy before that was Mike Smith in Atlanta. He had Matt Ryan, a really good young QB. He beat the Packers twice in very tough games at Lambeau in 2008 and then at Atlanta 2010, 3 points each. Smith worried McCarthy because he knew all about turnover differential, and he was very good at it, and his teams won with turnover differential. And McCarthy knew that was the secret to this business a long time ago. And when he saw Mike Smith coming through, a very poised guy, a defensive guy, who had a receiver and a quarterback, he knew it was tough. But boy, McCarthy, he blew, massacred Smith in that 2010 divisional playoff in Atlanta in unforgettable fashion. Beat him three more times, and bye-bye Mike Smith. He's fired.
I got a question for you. You and I have talked about this. I've heard it from other people about how McCarthy is extremely meticulous when he takes notes, how he pays attention to all this stuff. He has people that look into advanced stats, that track everything now. They've got those GPS devices that he cites all the time. I don't have any doubt that he has a general idea of what his record is in the division, because that's pretty obvious. You know, he knows he's kicked butt for the most part. When it comes to when he loses as a favorite, when it comes to winning at home as an underdog, when it comes to record against Super Bowl coaches, all these types of things that you and I would look at or that you looked at in this column, do you think he has general senses of where he stands in those types of things? Is he the type of person that is so obsessive, is not the right word, but so in tune with every single thing that goes on with him and his program that he knows these types of things? Not to the number, but to the general sense. Like if you were to say to him, you know, Mike, how many times do you think you've lost as a home underdog? Do you think he'd say 2? Would he say 15? Could he get close to 10? Does he know these types of things?
Maybe the odds stuff, Mike, is something I don't think they...
The point spreads, you mean, they don't care about?
You know, they can't talk about it in-house.
And, right.
Well, they can behind closed doors, but it's not something I don't think they dwell on. I mean, I do because it just gives me, you know, I got all this stuff going back 50 years, basically every NFL game, and I've always been into that, but...
Because you're sick.
Yeah, and we're doing it by ourselves, Mike, you know?
All we have
are ourselves and our own little records and notebooks and stuff that go way back for me. All right, let me mention a few more things about kind of the arc of McCarthy's career. So then he gets knocked out of the playoffs by Coughlin in 2011 in a second stunning playoff defeat administered by the Giants. In 2012, early in 2012, Pete Carroll's finally got a team. He's got Russell Wilson. He's got a dominating defense. He knows how to handle the turnover differential. And he beats the Packers in a very close finish at the end. People can talk about controversy and whatever. Hey, forget all that. The guy who was closest to that call made that call, and he had the eyes on the ball. And I don't care where he came from. He was closer than any replay. Don't get me going on that. We've discussed that for years. Fail Mary. It was a close call. All right. But so then Carroll obviously became an adversary. But there was another one in the NFC South with Jim Harbaugh. And Harbaugh beat Green Bay. No, he didn't. Yeah, he beat Green Bay twice with Alex Smith.
Wouldn't that be the West?
Yeah, NFC West.
Okay.
He beat Green Bay twice with Alex Smith in 2012. No, I'm sorry. I got my years mixed up. I know Alex Smith beat Green Bay at Lambeau, but then Kaepernick came back and won the playoff game, and then he beat him twice the next year. So anyway, Jim Harbaugh was 4-0 against McCarthy, and Carroll's 3-1. And they did it with running QBs, very physical offensive line, not offensive lines, physical running backs. San Francisco had a physical offensive line, and superior defenses. So Harbaugh runs into a problem with management. He's the odd man out. He goes to Michigan. A huge plus for McCarthy, obviously, to get rid of this guy he couldn't beat, this nemesis.
I thought you were going to say a huge plus for Michigan.
I would second that, Mike. And then Carroll wins a Super Bowl. Now, McCarthy needs to have a performance like he showed against the New England Patriots in November 30 of 2014. It was one of the greatest games ever played at Lambeau Field, Mike. No turnovers, beautifully played, wonderfully coached. McCarthy was unreal that day with some of the play calling, some of the execution, the creativity, players in different roles. You don't just sit there and roll a ball out and beat Bill Belichick, and he didn't. Belichick gave him a gracious handshake, a warm handshake. They talked for probably 30 seconds. Belichick said very kind things about McCarthy, and rightly so. It was a tremendous victory. 9 weeks later, we thought it would be Green Bay and the Patriots in the title game, in the Super Bowl. But then the calamitous collapse out in Seattle. McCarthy is one of many people to blame. And so that's where we are. Bruce Arians replaces Harbaugh out there. He beats McCarthy twice last year. So McCarthy needs a victory, Mike, against somebody good. And the Carroll and the Seahawks are good. And that really what it comes down to. Does that make any sense?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And I'm interested in it for a couple of reasons. So my first year here was after that 2014 NFC Championship game. And so when the Seahawks came here in week two last year, that was, and again, I was early in my time here in Green Bay, but I just remember that was a night game. It was the Sunday night game. I remember I had some errands to do that day, and I was just driving around, and the place was just electric. I mean, it was warm still. You know, people are outside tailgating. I believe it was nice weather that night. And then, you know, the game itself, we were in the locker room a couple times this week, and players said it was the loudest they'd ever heard the stadium. So that, to me, was as motivated as I've seen the Packers since I've been here for any game. And so now we're beyond that. You know, this is a struggle. This is a season where they're 6-6 trying to make the playoffs. This is a season where Seattle is almost certainly going to make the playoffs if they haven't already clinched it already. I haven't looked at the standings
Not
in
yet.
A couple of days. Okay.
Yep.
So my question is, can they replicate that environment again? And we'll have to see. It's going to be really interesting for me to see if that same level of disdain is still there without the freshness of that NFC Championship.
I mean,
game.
I don't think so, Mike. You know, and this team is 6-6. That one was 1-0, coming off a good season.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't think in cold weather and snow is going to diminish noise and energy.
In other words, without that perfect environment, that unbelievable noise, it's going to really come down to no boost from the crowd, no boost from the weather. This is who can win a football game. And so to me, this is far and away the toughest test the Packers will have, I think, this season, unless it comes down to some sort of a do-or-die game against Detroit, that kind of a thing. But yeah. I don't think that – maybe I'm overplaying it, but to me, I think this is just an absolutely massive game, not only for this season, but just to see what this team really is.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you all the way, Mike. Yep.
So should we take a quick break and then
sure.
take a look at this Seahawks team?
Yep.
All right, here's a word from our sponsor, and then we'll come back with our weekly scouting report.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
All right, Seattle on offense, the coordinator is Darrell Bevell, the ex-Packer quarterback coach. I think he's an excellent play caller. I've always thought that. The design of that offense is interesting. Carroll gives him carte blanche, I think. He has a bunch of experienced assistants. Sherman Smith, Carl Smith, these guys have been around a long time. They've been together a long time. It's a heck of a staff. It all starts with Russell Wilson. He's 5'10 and a half, Wunderlich of 28, ran 4.55, I believe. He's a remarkable player, Mike. That's all you can say. I mean, he is really, really good. I just go on and on with this guy. In that Super Bowl, the games against Green Bay, every time you see him, he plays hurt through all this bad knee and ankle this year. Now he's healthy. He's running. You know, he's deeper in the pocket to see over people. And it works. He's got a really good arm. He throws a tight spiral, and his improvisational stuff is really incredible. He makes some crazy throws to his left and his right. Every now and then he'll make a bad throw. There's no question. He does. And
who doesn't?
Yeah. And, you know, he's not a downfield thrower like Dan Fouts or Tom Brady or something like that. You know, no, he's not at that level. But, boy, he's such a leader, too. And this guy is an amazing player, and what a pick by John Schneider. Everybody around the league says Schneider was high on him for months before that pick, and I believe that to be true. A lot of people wish they had done something before John Schneider and the Seahawks did. He's totally turned the franchise around, really. Okay, the running backs, Thomas Rawls, a guy who got thrown out of Michigan after 3 years, went to Central Michigan, finished up. He's kind of a mini poor man's Marshawn Lynch. He runs really hard. He's now healthy. He's missed a bunch of time each of the last 2 years, this year included. Tough guy. He's hard to bring down. He's got a jump cut, too. He's not going to just run into people. He has some talent. He's definitely got a lot better vision than Kristen Michael.
He made that really nice cut against Carolina over the weekend where he went up the middle on a run. It was blocked up. He jump cut to the outside, and it was as if he lost no speed in that jump cut. I was impressed.
Yep. So they got rid of Michael. Now, the backup would have been C.J. Procise from Notre Dame, the rookie. He's got a shoulder blade injury, and he's out. So that's a problem. Alex Collins, like a fourth-round pick from Arkansas, they must not be high on him because the number two is Troymaine Pope, who got activated from the practice squad here recently. Pope is a rookie free agent from Jacksonville State of Alabama.
He's a mighty mite. He's tiny.
5'8"-ish. 205, runs 4.55. The fullback, concussion, Will Tukuafu?
Sure.
Yep, he's a
veteran. Let's go with that.
Will is down, so they got the ex-Raider, Marcel Reese, who hasn't played since early September. So Reese will probably be active. He's a really good receiver and runner. At age 31, I doubt he's going to be hammering people on lead blocks. All right, receivers. Doug Baldwin, he's earned my total respect after calling him pedestrian and that whole group pedestrian for a while. The more I see a Doug Baldwin, he improves every year. He's really good. He's sudden. He's smart. He's really good after the catch. The Packers got to be very much aware of this guy. The only thing he doesn't have is height, but he's really good. Jermaine Kearse, who won the overtime title game with the catch down the middle. Jermaine Kearse is okay. He's a tough guy blocking. He's physical inside. He does not have a touchdown. He's okay.
You saw that one brutal block he had against Carolina?
I saw one of them, Mike.
Holy cow. Yep. I mean, it was a... I don't even remember what the play was, but I remember it was Baldwin, I think, that was involved and had the ball. Hmm. And it was sort of like, actually, it was kind of similar in terms of the style of hit to the hit Matthews had with Alan Barber.
Yeah.
It was a blindside block. I mean, he just put his shoulder through some defensive back's chest and flattened the guy. I was impressed.
The number three is Tyler Lockett, the second-year guy. Now, tear sweeps, flat screens, kick return, punt return. The guy runs 4.35, and he can go.
And I have a feeling he might come up in our special teams conversation a little bit later.
Number four was supposed to be Paul Richardson, a second-round pick, but he really hasn't. He's injured, and he's a deep threat, but he's kind of easy to knock off routes. So Tanner McAvoy, the ex-Badger QB and safety, every now and then he makes a play, and he's going to be active. All right, the tight end is Jimmy Graham. He and Baldwin are the go-to guys. Graham doesn't quite run his 4.53 anymore, but, you know, a massive red zone threat. They've integrated him now. Bevel and Wilson know what to do with the guy, and they're going to have to reckon with him. This is one of the best tight end groups in the entire league. I mean, nobody has this kind of depth. Luke Wilson, the Packers will remember him making plays against him. He can get down the field. He's 4.55, and he's now healthy. And Nick Vanette, the third-round pick this year, a rookie, you know, he's pretty good, too. He's the best blocker of the three, and he can threaten the seam. So they're awesome at tight end. All right, the offensive line. That's the worst part of this team. It has been for several years. The five starters who started the Super Bowl a couple years ago, they're all gone. So this is a makeshift group. You got two rookie starters. You got George Fant at left tackle. He's been there for about six games. He's a basketball player from Western Kentucky. 4 years of hoops, 1 year of football. I mean, he ran 4.84, Mike. He's only 296. He's a tremendous athlete. Long arms, almost 35 inches, but yet he doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, this is, he's getting a little better, yeah, but he doesn't know what he's doing. So whoever it is, you know, Dayton Jones or Peppers, they have a chance to really put heat on Wilson. Of course, Wilson will run away from it, but he might run into somebody else. He's going to miss, make the first guy miss.
How much would a healthy Clay Matthews have been licking his chops for a matchup like that?
Well, he would, but Clay generally doesn't bull guys too much, you know, and that's where Fant's most susceptible. He can maybe handle the outside speed.
So Perry would have enjoyed it then?
I think
so. With the bull rush and the strength?
I do, yeah. All right, the other rookie is Jermaine Ifedi, a first-round pick. He's at right guard. He was a left a tackle both sides at Texas A&M. Ifedi looks great. 36-inch arms, huge hands, 315. He's atypical. Tom Cable, the line coach, likes athletes. This guy is, he's an athlete, but he's also a huge guy. Ifedi won the job early in the year. He will get movement in the run game, and you see good stuff in the pass, but also there's mental mistakes, there's lack of awareness against stunts. He's not there yet by any means. The right tackle was Gary Gilliam for like 30 games, but now in that Tampa Bay debacle 2 weeks ago, they benched him and they went to Bradley Sowell, kind of a fifth-year guy who's really not very good. He's just a guy. And he's starting ahead of Gilliam. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if Gilliam, who has ability, if he doesn't maybe get his butt in gear and get back in the lineup if they challenge him, Cable and Carroll get after him this week. That's just a pure speculation. The center's their best player, Justin Britt. The Packers will remember him starting at right tackle as a rookie in 2014, left guard last year, all year. Now he's at center. He solidified the position. He's got short arms, which is fine for center. He's a good player. And the left guard is Mark Glowinski, a second-year guy, a fourth-round pick from where, West Virginia, I believe. He's okay. You isolate him. Mike Daniels can get after these inside people. There's no question. So that's the line. Reed's Odhiambo, a rookie third-round pick or fourth, I can't remember. He's a guy who can play guard and tackle, and he might see action. So that's their offense.
So I know that this offensive line has really, really struggled. And earlier in the year, Wilson was taking hits left and right and having a lot of problems. On the conference call with Pete Carroll, he said that he thinks that this line has actually improved a decent bit since the beginning of the season. I think it's kind of hard to judge that because now that Wilson has his mobility back, it's not as if he's a sitting duck back there. But from guys that you talk to, do they actually think that there has been any level of progress, no matter how small, on this O-line, or is it still just a train wreck, really?
It was a train wreck 11 days ago, Mike, in Tampa.
Yep.
But part of that problem was Britt didn't play, and this rookie Joey Hunt had to play, and he was a disaster. So, and then Gilliam started, and he got benched. So, you know, like we discussed, Mike, with the O-line earlier, if the track is slow, that helps the Seahawks. And now they have a good power back in Thomas Rawls, who he's not Marshawn Lynch, but he's better than Christian Michael. So they have a chance to pound the ball a little bit, you know. Ifedi can give you that, and Britt and Glowinski, that's the best thing Glowinski does is straight-ahead stuff. They have, Cables and his assistant Pat Rule, these people are veteran offensive line coaches, and they do a really good job with that scheme. So I think they can run and then play fake.
Okay.
But on this turf, Wilson's going to run around from guys who break free. He's just going to do it. He's hard to trap.
Now, with Procise gone, he was obviously a guy that caught a lot of passes out of the backfield. With Rawls, Collins, Pope, do they still have any sort of an out-of-the-backfield threat among those three guys, really?
No, not really. When they're going to throw it short, they're going to do that little flat screen stuff to Lockett and Baldwin, you know?
Gotcha.
Or throw short to Graham.
Gotcha.
All right, now the defense. So the coordinators have gone from Gus Bradley to Dan Quinn and now to Richard. What's his first name? He was the old DB coach. I remember talking to him at the Super Bowl. Chris Richard. Okay, Chris still runs that simplistic cover three. They don't blitz much, but they don't have to blitz much. All right, let's go right to the secondary with Earl Thomas, okay? You could argue Earl Thomas is the most valuable player on defense. Another scout, I asked him that, and he said he was third behind Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman. But I know people would argue that it's Earl Thomas. Earl Thomas is the emotional leader of that bunch. He's a vicious hitter, plays the ball, can really run. He's probably the best safety in football. He's out.
For what it's worth, Michael Bennett said he thinks Earl Thomas will end up in the Hall of Fame. No idea if it's true, but in terms of skill set, he thinks he's absolutely there.
Okay. So I think they're going to start Stephen Terrell at free safety. Now, he's in his third or fourth year, and this is his third team. He's been cut, moved around the league a bit. He's 5'10 and a half. He's no taller than Earl Thomas. They're short guys. This guy ran 4.38. That's what he's got. What he doesn't have are real good instincts. He hasn't shown the willingness really to sell out against the run, and he's had some problems biting on play action. So he has to stay deep for this team. It's a cover three look, and he's got to be in that deep middle primarily. All right, let's stay in the secondary. Richard Sherman is unbelievable at left corner. One game the Packers stayed totally away from the guy. That didn't work. Then they went after him, and that didn't work so much either. He's going to challenge Adams and Nelson, and they're going to have to be on their best game to get away from him. The right corner is Deshaun Shedd. It's been a real plus for them. They got rid of Maxwell a couple years ago, and it hasn't hurt him because Shedd, a former safety, has really come on. He's about 220, 6'1", runs about 4.56. His speed has been okay. He's good with his hands. He's a press guy. He fits perfectly in this cover three stuff, and he's had a good year. Now, I've speculated that because he's a safety, he could go back and they could start him there. I'll tell you about the other safe corners that could then come into play. Right now, the nickelback is Jeremy Lane. Oh, he suffered a terrible injury in that NFC title game against Green Bay. Might have been a thumb and a knee or something, I don't know, on the same play. He came back middle of last year. He's a good player. He has starting ability, Mike. So he's going to be a tough match for Randall Cobb. And then if they were to move Shedd to safety, then Lane goes outside, and Nico Thorpe, a former Raider guy, 6'1", 200, sub-4'4", long arms, and he's one of these classic Al Davis kind of picks. He's not a bad player. It's a good pickup.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was today when we talked to offensive coordinator Edgar Bennett, he was asked whether Sherman is still exclusively playing on that right side, or if he's moving around a little bit.
Left side.
Sorry. Defensive left, but offense is right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So whether or not he's moving around, if he's shadowing guys, et cetera. And Edgar basically said he does a little bit of everything. And the reason I'm curious about what you think about this situation, or maybe what you've heard from guys that you talk to, is that during the Carolina game, at one point they put a graphic up on the screen that looked at Sherman's numbers when he's playing on his preferred side versus when he's in the slot or not on his preferred side. And he gives his completion percentage goes up, the yards, the touchdowns, whenever he's not on his preferred side.
Mm.
So I was wondering if Sherman's location on the field came up at all when you talked to any scouts or personnel guys this week.
No, it didn't. And in the Carolina game, he seemed to be pretty much on that left side.
Okay.
That's all I happened to have time to see this week.
The reason I ask is I wonder if they would put him on Jordy.
And match with him?
Yeah. And just say, hey, if Davante Adams wants to beat us, then go for it. Mm. But we're going to take one guy out.
Be interesting to see. The strong safety who did not play against the Packers last year, Cam Chancellor, he was holding out. Chancellor is a really smart player. He's kind of a glue guy. He's an enforcer at about 230. He's going to play in the box. He's going to lurk in coverage. He'll spy, and he will probably try to cover Jared Cook. He's a Pro Bowl-type box safety. He's really good. All right, so that's the secondary. All right, the front. Michael Bennett will be playing now his second game back from a knee sculpt. He missed five games.
Sounds like me. I'm going to miss two podcasts.
Yeah. Bennett is early in the year. He was unreal. He's about 275. He has the speed to turn a corner when he's an end, and he has the quickness to beat guards, and he's strong enough to play the point inside. He's a multiple threat, and He did not play good against Carolina. So maybe the extra week back, but he was nowhere near himself, I didn't think, last week.
I remember one thing about the buildup to that game last year in week two, outside of what I already described in terms of the environment on game day. And that was during the week, Josh Sitton was asked about Bennett. And this was during the time where Chancellor was still holding out, right? It was Chancellor that held out last year?
Yep.
Yeah. So basically, Sitton was asked, you know, what do you think of Michael Bennett? And Sitton was considered at that time among the best guards in the league, if he isn't still right now. And basically, his answer was, well, if Michael Bennett feels the need to hold out, I think he should start this week. I'd be totally okay with that. Let him hold out now, and he'll get more money. And to me, that was a heck of a compliment to say, look, this guy's so good that if he doesn't want to play, I'll be happy with it.
They have two other outstanding pass rushers, Mike, with the left end primarily, Cliff Averill, a former Lion for about 4 or 5 years. He has had no slippage at age 30. The guy's just got a knack. He's still got speed rush, and he's pretty strong against the run, too. And then you got Frank Clark, a second-round pick in 2015. Clark is 275, but he has the leverage, this two-hand shove kind of, that he can rush inside and often does against guards. Hard-charging guy. He's playing a lot better than he did in college. He's probably as good as Averill, really. So that's three. And their fourth guy outside is Cassius Marsh, who doesn't have the talent of those three, but he really brings it pretty hard. And, you know, he's a pretty good rusher. So that's their four outside rushers. It's one of the best in the league. Inside, you got three guys. I think the best is Atta Rubin, the former Brown nose tackle. Good player. He replaced Brandon Mebane last year, who was a great player for 8 or 10 years. Rubin shows some range in addition to stoutness at the point. You got the rookie from Alabama, Jerron Reed, a second-round pick. Not much pass rush, but very strong and very stout. Tony McDaniel, the tall veteran, has been a pretty good player, Dolphins and somewhere. He's awful tall, 6'6", I think. He does get washed. I don't think he's quite what he was. All right, on the inside, the two backers who play every snap, you got Bobby Wagner, kind of a middle, and K.J. Wright, kind of a Sam. Wagner, he can fly. He makes big plays. He's a good tackler. His instincts are a little off, but he's played so many years now that that's not a problem. He's outstanding. K.J. Wright might be having his best year. The guy can cover any tight end in the business. Tremendous in coverage. Consistent as heck. 4.75, not great speed, but again, he gets a jump on the ball. He's really good. Mike Morgan sometimes plays. Huge drop-off to Morgan. He's kind of just a guy. That's their defense. Let's go to special teams. Steven Hauschka had kind of a dry spell here at midseason. He's bounced back. He's a good kicker. You got John Ryan, the former Packer punter. He's been there 9 years now in Seattle. Really good guy, Canadian. He will outkick his coverage, but he's still good. Tyler Lockett, one of the real top two or three dual threat return guys in the league. Speed, he's daring. Packers got to be on their P's and Q's with him. Got Brian Schneider, a veteran coordinator. Best player is maybe Nico Thorpe and Kelsey McCray. Their coverage teams are good. That's Pete Carroll's squad. They're 8-3-1, and they're 3-point favorites.
What do you think of the spread? Reasonable?
Yeah, I think so. So they're saying Seattle's about 6 points better.
It was -2.5 earlier this week. Mm-hmm. So that means people betting Seattle.
Yeah, a little bit. So it's a game the Packers can win. There's no question about that. They beat this team, you know, a year ago, and they can beat them again. But they got to play well to do it. Seattle's going to be a tough bunch.
We'll have to see. I scanned through my Twitter feed here where I get a bunch of questions each week, and there actually weren't very many this week. I think there's probably a lot of people watching that football game, Bob. Nobody's paying attention to Twitter.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to skip the questions this time.
Okay.
And that means we get to your music faster. So remind everybody what we've got here on the way out. A fine, fine selection.
Mr. Lou Rawls, man.
Related to Thomas or no?
I doubt that. Mr. Lou Rawls, huh? Smooth, man.
And the name of the song?
You'll Never Find.
All right. We'll talk to you guys perhaps next week, although I might be on crutches. See you guys soon.
Oh, I'm not bragging on myself, baby, but I'm the one who loves you, and there's no one else. No.
divine.